Welcome to another episode of the Open Wound Research podcast. I'm very excited about today's guest, who is a luminary in wound care research. She has written many papers that I am very jealous of and wish to emulate in the future, and that is the great Marissa Carter. How are you doing, Marissa?
Nice to be here, Swelly, and thank you so much for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you, and I'm just very excited about all the subjects we're going to get into. As I mentioned earlier, just very excited about what you've written and the force that you've been in wound care over the past more than, by my count, 15 years at least. Let me do a quick introduction, and this one's going to be rather lengthy today just because of your accomplishments. So Marissa received her bachelor's from Oxford University in biochemistry, which she duly followed up with a master's in biochemistry as well, at which point she crossed the pond over to the United States, where she received her PhD from Brandeis University in organic chemistry. And at this point, she's the leading clinical trial specialist, I would argue. Technically, she's a clinical trial specialist epidemiologist. I don't want to cut that piece out of things. She has published about 150 publications in medical and chemistry journals and textbook chapters. She's a peer reviewer in many journals, such as the British Medical Journal, the British Medical Journal's Open Journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of Wound Care, Wound Repair and Regeneration, and the International Wound Journal. And there are more, but I think you guys get the point. She's also won some major awards, the Dr. Robert A. Warner III Memorial Award, the APWCA Status of Master credential, which she received, as well as the Roberta Abruzzi Publishing Award. She holds many memberships across some seminal wound care organizations, such as the APWCA, the WHS, the AAWC, the ACHM, which was a new one for me. I'd heard the full name, but not the acronym, and ISPOR as well, which is International Society for Pharmacognomics and Outcomes Research. She's also a member of the Wound Care Collaborative Community, which allies with the FDA to advance wound care and to discover better ways to do research and evidence in wound care. So with that massive introduction, I want to take us back to the start of the journey. How did you get into science? I mean, you ended up at Oxford, but how did you get there?
It's actually an interesting story. When I was about 5 years old, and this is in primary school in the UK, our headmaster decided to teach us kids a science lesson. So he got a treacle tin, which was probably about half a gallon in size. And he boiled some water, which he poured into the tin. He let it sit for a while, so steam's coming out, and then he caps it. And he goes, watch. And of course, if you know anything about physics, you see classically the tin starts to crumple like this as if magic, right? And, you know, the kids are going, ooh, ah. And I'm thinking, what is that thing that is making it do that? And if there was one seminal thing that caused me to go down the science path, that was it. Because shortly after that, you know, we had microscopes. At age 11, I had my own chemistry set in the garage, which was shut down 3 years later because of some unauthorized experiments. And eventually, of course, I went to university. By that time, I had been reading university texts for a long time. And it was very clear, no, this person really shouldn't be doing dangerous chemistry. Well, let's put her into biochemistry. That's boring and safe, right? And you know, it's not a bad thing to be put into a discipline that is boring and safe when you eventually do find out it's actually kind of interesting. So in a sense, I did start in medical research because after university, that's where I went into. But it's a long, convoluted pathway before I eventually came back into medical research about 20 years ago or so.
And so coming across the pond, I mean, Oxford, most people should know what Oxford is. What made you come over to the United States to study at Brandeis?
Married to a Brit. So, you know, I'm the Brit and the other one's American. So, you know, it's one of those things that I suppose I was always destined to cross the pond. You know, my family wasn't very happy about that, but it's what it is. I had a fellowship waiting for me at MIT. That was before I did my PhD, you know. So in a sense, it was opening eyes and deciding, what did I really want to do? And that, it turns out, took a long time. And if there's one thing about me, I will say, I get bored pretty easily. And so if you look to my entire career, you would find, gosh, she's been every which way in all kinds of areas of science and medicine. And that's because I keep wanting to do new challenges. I keep wanting to find out new things. And that's what I continue to do.
Wow, that's brilliant. And so you finish up at Brandeis. Again, your publications, you can see you did travel a long way. You're a sojourner, a wanderer of sorts. How did you make your way directly into wound care?
Right. So at the end of 1999, I was done with all my previous careers and in things in industry and so forth. So I started a new business, and it wasn't long. I actually put my own website up. I had to learn how to do all the HTML programming. And Dr. Fife came along at some point and said, can you write medical papers? And I said, sure. And shortly after that, she said, can you do statistical analysis? And I said, yeah. She said, can you do statistical analysis of big data sets? And that I wasn't so sure about. But you have to remember, this is a long time ago, and pretty much nobody knew how to do analysis of big data sets in medicine. So I thought, how hard can this be? Their statistician was retiring, and they were expanding the U.S. wound registry. So she let me play around for a while and get acclimatized to it. And then pretty soon we started analysis of data and started churning out papers. You know, each one was a lesson for me, and also how not to do things incorrectly, because there is no gold standard at that point, and you're having to learn how to mess with big data sets. So it's a little bit trial and error at that point.
Absolutely. And at that point, I guess, were you using open source tools? Were you using proprietary tools, or just kind of hodgepodging managing that?
But most of the stuff that you have in those days didn't exist. Yes, we had, you know, major statistical programs. I mean, R was just about creeping along and so on like that. But so you have to walk before you can run. And so in a sense, you handed this big data set and you have to look at the data, right? And you realize, God, this is incredibly messy data. You know, there's a lot of stuff missing. There's all kinds of weird values that shouldn't be there. And you're not even sure when you look at a particular wound type if that really is a particular wound type. So a lot of it is learning how to handle a big data set in a statistics program and, you know, deciding what to do with the data, you know, where people are asking you, hey, can you do this? Can you compare this to this? You know, and so another example might be, well, how do you create cohorts? You know, well, there was some published literature about that, but it was minimal. And so a lot of this stuff is trial and error and starting to talk to other statisticians, because we're all getting into the same boat and we're all finding out lots of interesting and strange things. So start eventually coming out with best practices. And, you know, come today, you know, we've made a lot of progress. But if you look at, for example, one of the big projects of the WCCC is real world data handling. You know, natural history of wounds, things like that. And that's, they're finding out, and I did start to chair that committee before I switched over, and found this is going to take a long time, several years. And part of it is because even though we as statisticians and medical researchers have tried to implement standards over the years, those haven't stuck. And as a peer reviewer, I can tell you, I've read innumerable real-world evidence papers, and some of them are terrible. You know, in a sense, they're very deserving of my epic fail red stamp. But so the WCCC project there is to set the gold standards, you know, and then the big problem after that is, how do you implement them? That's going to be another part too.
Talking about, you know, real-world evidence, we at Open Wound Research deal with registry work, etc., and the cleaning of data. is just, I don't think people quite understand unless they've actually done it, that the quality of data going in can vary immensely, especially on fields that are free text. I mean, talk about wanting to jump off a cliff in terms of trying to clean and normalize. And I think, you know, to your point, real world evidence, it's all well and good that we have these mountains of data, but if the data is not normalized, it's not clean, and it's not interoperable, it's not of much use to anyone, you know? And so I get the challenge, I feel the pain. I could see your face harkening back to the hours of cleaning data. I could definitely feel that pain.
Yeah, I mean, it could take days, sometimes weeks, if you really want to have a very clean data set. You know, and although it's pre-specified these days, because we pretty much know what it is, how and where we need to clean up the data set, it still takes a long time. And some parts of data sets are relatively unstructured, as you alluded to. So you have to look at all that free text stuff and think, how am I going to deal with that? How am I going to extract that data and put it into structured fields? And so in a sense, sometimes you will have a pre-specified plan to do that, but some of this stuff is done on the fly because you've never seen this data before, and you realize, oh my God, it's worse than I thought. So you're going to have to, you know, copy all your notes as you go. I mean, when I started doing this, and you know, I kept what's called a log file, and that is kind of a thing of, well, I have this data set, and now I'm keeping a log of all the things that I'm doing to this, and eventually putting this into a methodological program of, yeah, this is what we actually did. And I still do that. It's a habit, because there will be some things I will have not seen before in quite that shape and form, and I'm going to have to come up with a way of cleaning it up and making a sense of it and putting it into structured data fields. So in a sense, even when I tackle a new big data set problem, still going to have to do all that stuff.
Absolutely. One of the things that we've started working with that me and the data team is, I was faced with that problem, having to remember what I did, how I did it, etc. And what we've started doing is putting things through GitHub, right? So that every step is logged and we can go back and get best practices, etc. Because that, you know, not every data set's the same. And mm-hmm. the way, the cadence of how you do things is just can be very different.
I suppose I'm old school. I mean, when I did my PhD, we had lab notebooks, you know, and those eventually became part of the institution's programs and projects. So you learn how to do a lab notebook properly, and you know, everything you do has to be written down, and you learn really that you need to do it right, and it's not going to be a sloppy thing in terrible cursive handwriting that nobody can read. So in a sense, that was the first beginning, and it's translated throughout my whole life. I keep copious notes. Now, of course, I have a computer and I can structure things and make things look pretty. But sometimes it is the small things that actually make the difference, because if you don't do that, you know, sometime a few years later, you go, God, I remember that. I've seen this before. I've done it before. And you can't remember exactly how you did it because you didn't write it down. So that teaches you even the small stuff. You got to write it down and put it into your logs and use it, because you just never know when you may need to use it again. And it's one thing I really hate. It's reinventing the wheel and having to relearn something because I was sloppy the first time around. I'll give you a story from back in the 80s when I was running a pilot lab and I'm doing polymerization work and for monomers. And I was developing new catalysts, and unfortunately I allowed myself to get distracted because I had several texts to supervise, and I had missed out writing down a crucial step for this new catalyst. I could not figure this out to save my life, and even to this day I don't know what I missed out and what I did. So sometimes those things teach you very valuable lessons that you're never ever going to do this again, are you?
The pain of not remembering or failed. Yeah. I think it was Nicholas Taleb who said, mistakes teach you far more than successes.
Absolutely, they do. I mean, all the winners and all successes, you know, you look at the papers I've written, you think, oh, that doesn't look too hard. Actually, you don't really know all the horror and the tears and the yelling and screaming, especially, you know, when you don't get it right. So, those things that go wrong teach you far more than the things that go right.
Absolutely. You've had this long pathway in wound care, and when I was doing my research, I was going back into the wound care literature and looking at how papers had changed over time. It seemed to me that there's definitely been a shift towards perhaps more sophisticated methods, RCT, etc. But I just wanted to get your feel of where, you know, wound care research was in, let's say, 2010, 2015, and where we are today.
So I first started designing serious clinical trials around about 15 years ago, and believe me, sorry state of things. So I thought about this in a couple of different ways, and the first was, how can we gradually elevate the way we design trials to make them better? You know, what are the current best practices? So that got started, and you know, I started writing my first protocols and with that in mind. And the second thing I was thinking of, this needs to happen on a much larger scale. And for example, one of the things we did in the Alliance of Wound Care Stakeholders is we published a power paper, which lays out in gory detail the things that you need to do in medical research as far as clinical trial design and other things go. So in a sense, things were not good then, and we have made progress. I mean, I think we are better now than we were in those days. But that said, one of the things I remember from a year and a half ago, actually it's almost 2 years ago now, when the FDA held a workshop in wound care, is one of the lecturers said, you know, if I compare FDA controlled trials, meaning you've had a series of interactions with the FDA because you've got a PMA, you've got a BLA or a drug going, versus the ones that are post-market, those two different sets of trials are very different. The post-market trials are not so rigorous. And in fact, when as a systematic review, you're going to score them down. So we have a long way to go. And in fact, one of the things in the WCCC was we have and still have a group that looks at clinical trial design. Have we made much progress? Well, one of the reasons is we find out we have a lot of baby steps to do before we can even get there.
that makes sense. And kind of following up on that question, we post and go back and forth on LinkedIn, and you tolerate my constant ruminations and jabbing at just a general state of things, but we've talked about non-normality of data. We've talked about certain ways that people are, you know, maybe misweighting evidence, the methodologies. What in your mind at this juncture, some of the big epistemological challenges in wound care?
I would say it really has to do with this EBM concept, evidence-based medicine. You know, back in the 90s, it was a grand concept. It was a good idea because a lot of the stuff that we were publishing in the 90s was okay. But that said, you couldn't replicate a lot of it. Some of it was, in British terms, very dodgy looking. And so the concept of EBM is, if I have an intervention or a group of interventions, I want to be able to look at all of those things together in some framework and make a judgment on it. So EBM has evolved over the years, but in the last 10 years, there's been this perhaps over fascination on randomized controlled trials. One of the things that you have to see is randomized controlled trials are a necessary step in evolution of developing evidence for some intervention or some program. But that said, most of those trials really only affect a small area of the population. So if you could imagine, this is wound care here. This is your trial here in terms of the generalizability of the population. that's a problem. So if you fascinate yourself too much on RCTs, you think, oh, wow, we've got a lot of evidence here. It's got these RCTs, meta-analyses, systematic reviews. But guess what? It doesn't apply to most of the population. So what's the problem? And I think what's happened is evidence-based medicine has got too top-heavy with control trials. It hasn't done enough in the real world to look at all the real-world evidence analysis and data to complement it. Because these two things are definitely complementary. You've got to have two. You can't just have one without the other. And that's what I see that's gone missing in EBM. And, you know, you look at regulatory agencies, they've made, like the FDA has made tremendous strides in understanding how real world data can be applied when you have an IND, when you have something new and you want to get it approved. But the payers, CMS and private ones too, have a long way to go to understanding that. And sometimes not without good reason. And when we talked about gold standards and the lack of them. So if you're sitting in a high seat and you're not really savvy on this stuff, so you look at some of the stuff that's been published on real world data and you get a little dismayed because it's short on methods and a little bit short sometimes on credibility. So you're going to go, well, that's it. I'm done with that. I'm just going to focus on RCTs. So you can see how that viewpoint comes about. But that said, we do need to take a step back. We do need to say, not everything in evidence-based medicine needs to be about controlled trials. We need to look at real-world data. We need to look at mechanisms. We need to look at a lot of the new genetic analysis and stuff that's been coming out in the last 10 years and say, it's not just always about clinical trials in humans. It's actually about, how does this thing actually work? Does it work the way it's supposed to? Have we done everything that we're supposed to understand how this works? Because it's wonderful to have clinical trial data and it looks nice, but you really need to understand the bigger context of that and say, should it be really used in these populations? Is that the best place for it?
That's a great point. I think we had spoken, you know, maybe a year ago, and one thing that's always struck me about wound care compared to other areas of medicine or other sciences is many times there's a lack of a model, right? There's this works, okay? How does it work? What's the model of how it works? And then putting that model into a statistical analysis and say, okay, does the model fit the emission of the data, right? And I know you've done a lot of this work, and I talk all the time with clinicians, and I go, if you can explain the model that you believe this is working through, we can do better statistics and a better understanding of what's actually going on with the science. And I think Harm Smit, our friendly Dutch friend, he talks about this a lot. And I think it's a kind of an obsession for him, through his five models, et cetera. But that notwithstanding, how do you think that we in the wound care community can do better in connecting the theory, the clinical, and the quantitative analysis, and tying those three things closer together?
So one of the things that I remember, and I've had this conversation several times with FDA people, and that is, the FDA's real mandate is to say, you're going to do a series of trials for each independent type of wound, right? So, you know, if you do it in diabetic foot ulcers, you've got to do another set in venous leg ulcers, pressure injuries, and something like that. This is the perfect worldview, as I call it, you know, and it's kind of looking at the world in blinkers, right? Because when you look at real world wounds, you're going to find pure wounds of every virtually the common three types and some others too, but not always. Mixed etiology wounds are very common. Venous leg ulcers with an arterial problem, diabetic foot ulcers with a pressure problem. And so it goes. And in a sense, this is where this disconnect between real world and controlled perfect world has actually come about. But that said, I think there is an increasing recognition that wounds have common healing mechanisms. they will certainly, for etiology purposes and development of a wound, have different mechanisms, and that's fine. You know, in a sense, how did that wound happen? Well, you know, in a diabetic foot ulcers, it's typically to do with the fact you've got too much glucose in your body floating around. With a pressure injury, you know, you've got too much pressure on a focal point. So how a wound forms does affect wound healing and how you're going to deal with it. But that said, there's commonality between all kinds of wounds. I'm always fascinated by the fact that in Europe, they look at things as mostly chronic wounds. You know, chronic wounds, anything that's just not healing the way it's supposed to. Whereas in North America, we tend to separate out all these wounds as though that's the way the world is, forgetting that these are just very focused ways of looking at wounds. So I think in the future, what I'd like to see in the next 10 years is let's go back to commonalities. Let's understand, yeah, we have different mechanisms to form a wound, but we have common mechanisms to heal a wound.
That sounds like going back down into the biology, right, and the physics yep. of the matter.
Yeah, so harm's not wrong. I mean, I think, you know, if you need to look at, forget the etiology, and then look at what are the problems affecting the wound and how you're going to deal with it and healing it, you know, and the recurrence and all the rest of it. So look at it from more of a general mechanistic viewpoint, look at it then drill down to the biochemistry and the genetics, and you're going to find some commonalities.
I think that's the future, because like you, I feel like some of these distinctions are somewhat ad hoc, and they stop people from thinking.
They do. It's you know, we like to simplify things. Humans love to simplify things. You know, statisticians, we take messy data, we categorize it and structure it. But remember, every time you do that, you lose information. I mean, the classic statistical thing I remember from learning back in the 70s is, you know, so you have a bunch of continuous data. For some reason, it's messy, it's not normal. So, okay, so we're going to structure it into categories. And every time you do that, you lose some data and information. There's nothing wrong with it if you understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. But in the same way, if you look at chronic wounds and do that same thing, a lot of people walk away with the message of, I just keep seeing these specific kinds of wounds, but I don't see them in my office, you know. Why is that?
It's funny because when I used to, with my partner's own wound care consultancy with, you know, 40 plus providers, and I noticed over time that the more experienced, more expert clinicians would take down these walls between wounds. And they were really interested in understanding the story of the wound, whether it was how it came about, how it's progressed, and how it's healing. And I noticed consistently that they wouldn't say, oh, stage two. They would say, okay, what has happened in the pathway?
I agree. I mean, I've had some wonderful mentors that taught me the clinical aspects of chronic wounds, you know, and they would always see it that way too. And so they would say, you know, they could give you the history of a patient and they could say, well, this is why it's so. You know, this is why you're not going to find this in a classic chronic handbook of wounds. Oh, it's not a venous leg ulcer. There are a lot of other things going on. And so you understand from these people the real world as it is, how they deal with it every day that comes, you know, patient walks in the door.
No, absolutely. I think dealing with that uncertainty of type or uncertainty in wounds is just something that we need to get used to. And also on the quantitative side, I think back in the day, I'm saying strange things by saying it that way, but before we didn't have the computational tools to non-discretize. And I think at this point, given all the tools we have, we don't have a reason as statisticians or data scientists to discretize anymore, unless there's some obvious reason.
That's true. That's very true.
So your current work, you mentioned the WCCC, and I attended a session at SOC Spring, which was fantastic. But can you talk about some of your current work at the WCCC and some of the projects that excite you?
Yeah, so going back to clinical trial design, as I mentioned earlier, we've got to take some baby steps before we can start coming out with espousing more robust designs. And that is, think about reporting clinical trial results. one of the things I always got frustrated, and I've peer reviewed for a long time, and I keep seeing missing data, you know, and so over the years, I've actually collected what kind of data are we missing, you know, and it's patient comorbidities, it's details of certain kinds of wounds and so forth. It's detailed treatments, it's standard of care. I mean, the standard of care heterogeneity has actually become its own project. So Dr. Maribel Henao is heading up that one, and I have spent a little time with her group working on that. But my forte is to say, all right, then, what are we going to do about clinical trial reporting? Why would you want to come up with a set of rules about that? And the answer is, going back about 15, 20 years ago, a group of very smart people came up with the consult criteria. So anytime you run a randomized controlled trial, here's the checklist. Here's the rationale for each of those points in the checklist. And so in a sense, what I'm thinking is a similar kind of thing for reporting of wound care studies, you know, and it might fall into patient demographics, patient comorbidities, certain kinds of treatments and things like that. Well, naively, I thought at the beginning of the trial, this project was going to be fairly easy. And I realized after a while, it's not. My way of looking at things and most other people's are very different. So we've actually finally started focusing and looking at prognostic models. And for those of you who don't understand what that is, that's a way of putting together mathematically a model that says, if I have all these elements about patients' wounds and treatments and things, how can I actually project into the future whether a wound will heal or not, or when it might heal, or something like that? Or you could think about amputations, infection, all kinds of things. So we're actually going to take systematic reviews of prognostic models, and we're actually going to look at all the individual studies that are cited. So, and part of the other problem is a massive amount of work, you know, in terms of literature searching, data extraction. And we now have Solentum to thank, who stepped up to the plate, and they're doing this whole thing for us. That means that when they're done, we can actually focus on looking at the actual data from the individual studies and saying which factors are the ones that look like they affect wound healing. I mean, I remember a conversation a very long time ago with Dr. David Margolis, who's always been one of my heroes and mentors in the wound care field. And going back to the late 90s, his minimalist theory about prognostics was you only need two things. You need the wound area and you need the wound age. And he showed fairly conclusively that if you build those two things into any model, somewhere of a 65% accurate prediction of wound healing and things like that. So the remainder of that, the 35%, is the challenging bit. And guess what? It's not one of two things. It's probably a couple of dozen of things. You know, I remember seeing about 3 or 4 years ago a paper coming out, and I think it came out of Berkeley, but don't hold me to that. Well, these guys had actually looked at ICD-10 codes, and they had about 800 or 900 terms of those things in an AI-driven black box model. It worked nicely because, you know, their AUC numbers were coming out to like 95, 96, 97%. What's the problem? I'm pretty sure they did not understand how those 800 terms interacted in the black box. So the issue is always in terms of these kinds of things is understanding that as you build a model and it explains more and more of what you're looking at, the further you go down that road, the harder it gets, the bigger it gets. And at some point you're going to go, I'm done.
Absolutely. I think we talked about we did a poster on projecting the cost of patients going forward, models that we borrowed from marketing literature. And, you know, we were working on them. And what I realized, and when I spoke to the team, I said, we want parsimony. We want models that we can explain to stakeholders that make sense and look at the behavior of patients versus the attributes of patients. And if you look at behavior over attributes, you tend to get much more of a lift in predictive power. And I think what you're describing from Dr. Magolis' work is that he's looking at behavior of the wound, which has a lot of weight in prediction. And I think a lot of times people that come in with machine learning, these black box models, they just want to keep adding covariates, right, ad mm-hmm. absurdum. And then at some point you go, how does it work?
Yeah, and you know, the AI thing is interesting because we're at a crossroads here. And I remember, this is going back 15, 20 years ago, when we used to call these things CDSSs, you know, and they were aid memoirs for clinicians, and they were computer-based. And the idea was, you know, you're in the ER, it's 1 a.m., and you're not experienced, and you're looking at something, and you need a little help because you're not going to get it anytime soon. That was the concept. I still believe in those kinds of approaches, but that said, if you understand intuitively what your model is telling you and how it got there, you're going to believe it a whole lot more than if you're dealing with a system that says, we're not going to tell you how we got there, but guess what, we're right. And then a lot of people are going to react to that and go, like, really? especially when you start finding out some of these models, when they fail hard, spew nonsense. So you worry a little bit in AI and medicine that's something you absolutely don't want. Clinicians will tell you the first thing you need to sign up to this job is cause no harm, right? So you don't want a diagnostic system to actually start causing problems with patients. So I think regardless of which side of the fence you sit on and your perspective, this whole thing does have to have some kind of intuitive belief, instruction, and feeling that what you're looking at is real.
I cannot agree with you more. If I may, we've got about 25 minutes, and I want to touch on some subjects because I just think you have great insight on these, and I don't want to get waylaid down the model route, because I know you and I could probably talk about that for 5 hours and still have plenty to spare. Yeah. When we were at SOC, one of the medical directors had visited with us and was talking about how they were assessing coverage for the quiet LCD that no one talks about in wound care, or I should say 8 or 9. In that, they were using the grade method. And you wrote a paper a couple of years back kind of introspecting the grade method. Could you perhaps talk about the grade method and how it's currently applicable in the LCD and how you see it going forward?
Well, yes. And let me say the first thing is I'm the first one to cheerlead these people on and say, I'm so glad you've chosen grade. If you know the history of these things, grade was the winner, and there were a lot of contenders going back 10, 20 years ago. But there is this misperception, I think, in some people who don't practice in this area, that grade is some kind of magic series of instructions or algorithms, and put everything in and you get this output and you go, oh, look, we're done. it doesn't work that way. Grade is still a very subjective process. It's got a lot of boxes, a lot of structure, and a lot of things to guide you on how to get to the decision make, but it's still a judgmental process. So what that means is anytime you use grade to judge a body of evidence, you're going to have several people who are part of that process. Individually, they're going to do a lot of the data collection and analysis, risk of bias, and so forth. But they're going to come together and they're going to disagree. And there has to be a transparent mechanism to reach consensus. And one of the things I noticed about this, probably it's going to be an infamous LCD, is it's missing. All of that stuff's missing. Doing grading is actually hard. It took me a long time to learn it. I have taught it, and believe me, some of my students are still rubbing their heads. It's a process. It's like systematic reviewing. It's just a different version of it. And in a sense, you have to learn how to do all the elements properly. And that takes a lot of practice. You know, you don't become a wound care physician overnight. You practice for several years and you get good at it. It's the same with grade. You can't start at this fresh and just have a go at it because it's not going to work. And some of the stuff I've seen in that LCD kind of hints at that. And another thing about grade is about judging bodies of evidence or something, you know. So for example, if you wanted to look at negative pressure wound therapy, or you wanted to look at HBO, you're going to be looking at a whole bunch of studies that you're going to ask questions like, does this thing work in certain kinds of wind? How well does it work? What are the limitations? What are the things that we really want to know about to use it? But in this case, the Macs have actually decided, rather than do that, they're going to use it for individual study judgment. And it was never designed to do that. So if you're going to go down that road, you've got to really transparently and clearly specify before you do this how you're actually going to do it. Because it's not obvious to me how you're actually going to do it. I mean, I guess I could come up with a version if I wanted to go down that road, but all of this is missing. So in a sense, I'm looking at this big black hole. I don't know how we got from A to B. And it kind of reminds me of a Gary Larson cartoon, which I have to tell you about. It's always been on my bulletin board. So imagine a bunch of scientists in front of a blackboard, you know, and there's step A, this is the beginning, and step B at the very end. And in the middle, you see written, and a miracle occurred. And, you know, I get this feeling when I first read this LCD, it's like, the miracle obviously occurred because I don't see how it happened. And so I worry about things like that a lot.
No, absolutely. Looking at grade, I kind of look at it through the lens of like kind of Bayesian, right? Like the pieces. And when I saw it, I had the same feeling as you as, hey, okay, fine, we're going to use subjectivity. I actually have no problem with subjectivity as long as we quantify it, right? Like, what is your belief that this is, or weighting certain evidence? So what I had expected was, okay, we arrived here. These were our probabilities for each piece of whatever it is. And then doing it in a methodological way so that someone could follow and say, okay, you weighted RCTs at 1, you weighted this observational study at 0.75. And then if we just do the math of the probabilities, we should get close to the theta of your decision. And to your point, we only see the decision.
Yeah, and in fact, my intuition, the more I read it and the more I ran some calculations, I did a lot of things, it seemed to me like, well, you focused on RCTs and you ignored every single observational or real-world study that came out. But if you're going to go down that road, this is kind of getting kind of silly very quickly. So in a sense, I think this is going to be a glorious bun fight, and I'm ready to pop the corn.
It's going to be a bun fight. I'm going to use that. Now, I like you, I admire the fact that they chose a system. And a system that, is steeped in evaluating evidence. I think that's important. But to your other point, if we're going to do it, then we need to lay bare the subjective probabilities, the weighting methodology, such that everyone can buy in. And to your point, if it's a black box, people don't buy in as much as if it's a white box and people can say, okay, I may not agree, but the methodology underlying the decision makes complete sense if that's the choices we make.
Yeah, the sausage making is important. And it's, that's just the nature of human behavior. And if you see something that's just being in dark spaces or people just gathering together, making decisions, you're not all like that because you're not part of it and you don't know how it's done. So in a sense, the more transparent you are and the more this is how we're going to do it, we've published it, we've registered it. If we make a few changes along the way, we're documenting it. That's a transparent process and everybody can buy into that. But the fact that it didn't happen just makes people incredibly suspicious, and rightly so.
Absolutely. Moving on from the grade, because again, another subject that we could talk a lot about, and I'm going to extend a secondary invitation already because I think there's going to be a lot to talk about over the coming months. So before the podcast even ends, I'm already extending another invitation for you to join us.
Hopefully. And I'd be delighted to come.
Brilliant. Talking about sort of these methods, in your papers, I think you're the only wound care statistician that I've seen who's used mixed effects models. I love them as a Bayesian. We love our mixed effects models. I just think they have a lot of power. They are flexible and they're intuitive. Could you walk us through like your use of mixed effects models, why you've chosen them methodology and kind of the advantages?
I'm a great fan of these things because they give me such room to maneuver. There's a lot of levers and bells and whistles to them that enable me to build different kinds of models. I remember the first time I published a simple mixed model in a wound care journal on a particular a randomized controlled trial. And I won't name names, but one of the clinicians said, "We've never done this. Why are we doing this now? Isn't this stupid?" And I'm thinking, you really don't want me to come in the ORR, learn all your procedures and surgical techniques and tell you, why are you doing that? This doesn't look good. But that said, I think while mixed models certainly have their place in randomized controlled trials, and we should use them a lot more, I mean, percentage area reduction is one, but there are other ones with PCOs and other things that we can use in outcomes. I think if we use them a lot more in real world studies, we'd get a lot more out of them. And I'll give you an example. So suppose you're a wound care management company and you've got a couple of hundred clinics scattered around the country, and you want to get an idea of what's going on in those clinics in regard to healing. And so you ask your favorite statistician, how would I do that? Well, in the old days, what you would do is you'd have a big data set. You'd have all the wound variables, the patient variables. You build models. You might even look at individual centers and start to stratify them in terms of performance. I mean, simple thing like a logistic regression, time to heal at time X, right? I mean, that sounds simple. In a big data set, obviously it's not, but that's what you would do. But you're missing on a huge part of that equation, and that is the real world isn't actually like that at all. It's actually structured. It has this thing we call hierarchy. So we start at the bottom of the food chain, as it were. Here are your wounds, and your patients have wounds. And some patients have one, but a lot of them, 40 to 50%, have a lot more than that, right? And then above that, you have physicians. So physicians see a lot of patients in their wounds. Above that is the site or the clinical building that people actually get seen in. And this is a hierarchy of things. And so what it means is these things are all correlated. Hierarchy and clustering are just fancy technical terms, but these things are actually all related to each other. So if you have, say, a fancy wound care center in a big city, it's got all the bells and whistles, all the imaging stuff, these people are trained, they know exactly what they're doing, they're going to have generally very good outcomes. Go over here, where I'm in a rural area, it's very hard to get actually really good docs to work in this facility. I've got patients that have to be transported 50 or 100 miles, so I don't get to see them very often. You're going to know that this one and this one are going to behave very differently, right? And so it is as you proceed down the hierarchy. I remember Dr. Fife showing me, she was lecturing several years ago. She had this great slide. She had a picture of this smiling Brit. She goes, why is he smiling? And well, the real story behind that is that his failure rates are terrible. Why is that? Because he's actually dealing with very, very sick people and very severe wounds. So he's not going to get great stats. And here we have payers naively saying, well, we really need to ding those kind of guys because they're not doing a good job. Well, you're not understanding what the structure is behind that particular position. So in a sense, what mixed models do is enable you to take that hierarchical structure into account. And it comes in two flavors, and we do these repeated measure versions, which we've done, and I'll look at percentage area reduction at time, A, B, C, D, E. But in a hierarchical version, I can actually incorporate all that structure. I can use random factors, fixed factors. And so at the end of the day, when I said to you at the beginning, well, I had this nice little logistic regression, and I calculated this effect size. I had pulled together these nice cohorts, even what I thought was nicely balanced. I got a pretty good effect size when I was looking at this intervention, this dressing or this biologic. Now I do my mixed modeling, and it takes a lot longer. I mean, you have to have some serious kit to do this in terms of silicon horsepower. It takes a long time. because the amount of math that you're doing, the computation is enormous. And that's actually one of the biggest problems is most of us shy away from this stuff because we don't have weeks to do this analysis, and most of us don't have these fancy computers to do it in a reasonable period of time, so we don't do it. But let's suppose you did do it and you did build this model. What you would want to look at now is this effect size in this simplistic way and the effect size in this hierarchical fashion. Then you'd find something very interesting. So suppose your effect size was, I don't know, in terms of big, small, or medium, but let's suppose it was medium. Let's say this intervention caused people to heal on average twice as fast. If you looked at the hierarchical version, it would be only maybe half as fast. And you'd say, why is that? And that's because you're looking at real world structure. Everything is related to each other in the real world, whereas in your simplistic model, it wasn't anything that you included at all. So that's one of the big reasons I love mixed models.
I'm a big fan too, in terms of the Bayesian variation for the exact same reason. You know, I had a client talking to me about a study design, and they had the hierarchies we'd expect, right? You have sites, you know, then you had patients within sites and then time points. And I said, you're missing the provider, right? Because there's a provider effect. And what we're trying to do is to try to account for all the levels of variance that interfere with the true treatment effect. And I had to explain it, and I drew it out, and I did a diagram. And he goes, oh, that makes complete sense. And I said, it's important because what if you have a site with three providers, right? And then one of those providers is seeing 50% of the patients, but the provider, I don't know, is a perpetual drunk, doesn't even know his real name, is barely adhering to your protocol. What would you expect, right? He's gonna perhaps have a high failure rate. If you don't adjust for the hierarchy, he's gonna infect that whole site's estimate, and you're gonna hide the true effect of the intervention. Whereas if you use a hierarchical mixed effects model, what's going to happen is that extreme finding is going to get dragged towards the mean at that site level, thus accounting for that variation. And it takes a while to walk people through it. And then, you know, he said, oh my God, that makes complete sense. And I think, you know, that's why I'm a fan of hierarchical models as well, because in the real world, we need to account for these variances, and they're everywhere.
Yeah, they are. I mean, I like Bayesian stuff because I think in some ways it's very intuitive. And I do remember going back probably around about 2002, there was a burst of randomized controlled trials that actually had Bayesian treatments of endpoints, you know, and I thought, well, that's really cool. And then it stopped. And I asked people, why do you think that happened? They said, well, people didn't understand it, and it seemed like it was different to everything else, you know, so it got hammered down. But to your point, yeah, I think the Bayesian approach is very intuitive in many ways. We could think about some amazing clinical trial designs in a Bayesian context. I'll be the first to tell you I'm not a Bayesian expert. It's only so many days in the month that I can actually work, but I have actually used Bayesian approaches in diagnostic approvals with the FDA, where we looked at evidence and we're looking at bits of evidence as we accumulate things to understand this is how things progressed. This is how the diagnostics got better when we took that data into account. So I am a fan. I may not be a practitioner of the art, but I really hope that sometime over the next 5 to 10 years, we see a lot more of it.
What do you think in terms of, and again, this is a little bit of a selfish question, but one of the issues that I found trying to propagate Bayesian statistics in wound care is that, number one, people are infatuated with p-values, right? And when you go, they're really on not meaningful, yeah, the posterior is what matters. People just kind of struggle. Their brains can't, out of the p-value world.
You can get yourself into a world of hurt very quickly by really not understanding what a p-value is. You know, so I say, here's a p-value of 0.03 with your intervention. What do you think about that? You know, how good is it? And they go, that sounds good. And I said, well, what does it mean? Is it like a 3% chance that we got it right? And they will go, well, yeah. And they go, no, that's not the right answer. you know, then you talk about one-sided, two-sided testing and all that, and then they just lost. And I said, so you really don't know what p-value is, do you? And in a sense, it's not an intuitive thing. Whereas I think when you look at a Bayesian approach to it, you know, where you just get all about this null testing or something like that, show me some credible intervals around whatever it is you're using at the mean. That's much more intuitive. I get that. The thing I've always liked about Bayes and I've always said to people is, you know, every time we test something in a frequentist statistics approach, we have to account for that. So we have to watch our type 1, type 2 errors. And it said in the Bayesian world, we don't worry about any of that stuff. And people go, really? I said, yeah. We can test every minute and every day. And guess what? There's no penalty because we don't care about what you care about in that world. It's a different way of looking at things. So I think if we taught Bayesian statistics, or at the very least, the Bayesian approach to analysis a lot more in a lot of places, it would be a good thing. People will get friendly with it, happy with it, and happy to see it in print.
That's brilliant. I'd love to work with you on advancing Bayesian methods. I think it's so much more intuitive for the clinicians. And in terms of clinical trials, again, I was talking to a possible sponsor, I should say. And I said, they said, well, you can only look at this point and this point. And as a Bayesian, I was like, no, there's no penalty for looking in the Bayesian world. And they're like, what? And I said, yeah, you can look. There's no penalty, you know, and kind of getting people to understand that. You could see their mind kind of slow down and start having this cognitive dissonance going on.
Yeah, I kind of like it's like, oh my God, we just went through the sound barrier.
Exactly. It was hilarious because I could literally watch him go, what? And I said, yeah, you could look at point, you could look 10 days into it, 5 days. It literally doesn't matter, you know, because we're updating our posterior as we go.
That's right.
You know. And one of the other benefits as well, and I was explaining this to someone, you know, in the frequentist world, when we're looking at a confidence interval, it's you're simulating from your likelihood, and then you have the interval. 95% of the time, it contains a true value, right? Whereas in the Bayesian, a credible interval contains a true value within those that interval, and over time, the interval decreases in size. It doesn't shift.
Yeah, and I would say a simplistic way of looking at this is in the frequentist world, we have these smoke and mirrors things where we kind of actually produce stuff and you look at it. Whereas in the Bayes world, what you see is what you get.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I would love to work with you to advance it, because I just think as we go into the world of real world evidence, I just frankly, I'm concerned if we use this frequentist methods that we'll never truly get to the answers that we want to get to, because we're limited by the apparatus that we're using. And that's not to say it's bad or good. It's just becoming attuned to the reality of that kind of data. So we have about 2 minutes and 45 seconds left. And I want to ask you the question that I ask all of our guests. If you were able to go back into the Arabian Nights and access the genie, and that genie were to grant you one wish in wound care, what wish would you have and why?
I thought about that actually last night. I do some of my favorite thinking in the tub, and I was thinking, one of our biggest problems is when you come up with a nicely set of rules and regulations, you know, you spent years and years doing this, is implementing it. Wouldn't it be nice if I had a magic wand and go, we've done it. Oh, now you can believe it and you're going to do it. Because frankly, all this amazing stuff that we do in all kinds of organizations about reporting or structuring or developing or getting a trial in a certain framework is ignored by 90% of the people who practice in this very care wound space. I mean, wound care is not unique, but if I had a magic wand so that people would believe it and they'd actually go do it, gosh, things would really change very fast.
That's the most direct selection that people have made, and I think it would be great. My mother would say, if she was still alive, you just take a stick and beat people, and you get a good effect out of that. But that's apparently illegal in most of the states.
Apparently it is.
Well, thank you so much. This hour's flown by, and I hope that the viewers and the listeners have learned a lot. I just think that you're just a shining light in wound care, and I thank you for the work that you have done and the work that you continue to do. And I look forward for any opportunity to speak to you and to work with you and to learn from you. And I just want to let you know I appreciate you.
Thank you very much. And I look forward to being on the show again. And again, thanks for having me.